Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We will call our third and last case for this calendar. 04-0901 Sheboygan County DSS versus Matthew S. Representing Rachel B. is John Brow. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is John Grau, and I do represent Rachel B., who is the appellant petitioner in this case. As you know, this case is a termination of parental rights case, and the reason we are here is to determine whether Rachel waived an objection she might have had to the court's loss of competency by not objecting in circuit court to the holding of a fact-finding hearing outside the normal mandatory time limit set by statute. The Court of Appeals in this case, in its opinion, opined that Rachel was probably correct on the merits regarding the timing of things, but determined to apply this Court's decision in Village of Trempealeau County, I believe it is, versus McCrutt, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing McCrutt correctly, which dealt with loss of competency as an issue and waiver, and determined in that case that if an objection is not raised in the circuit court, that the objection is waived. Just briefly, Your Honor, some of the procedural facts in this case are that on March 7th of 2003, a petition was filed to terminate my client's parental rights. On March 27th of 03, an initial hearing was heard. It's not on the record as part of that, but out of that hearing came a scheduling notice dated that date that set the fact-finding hearing for April 29th. At that initial hearing on March 27th, the father raised an issue through his attorney of a possible motion to sever. Trial court judge said, well, get it on because this has to be heard within 45 days. Then on April 3rd of 2003, the district attorney assigned to the case sent a letter to the court asking that the case be rescheduled because he had received the notice of scheduling. Apparently, he had not been consulted about the date prior to that. I'm not sure how it is done in Sheboygan County, but it sounds like a clerk merely sent out the date for the fact-finding hearing. It apparently was not agreed upon in open court when all the attorneys would have been there with their calendars. So he did write the letter. It's dated April 3rd. I assume it was hand-delivered because April 4th is the date of the notice of hearing that went out in response to the letter, which indicated that the matter was going to be heard on June 18th. That is the point where we believe that the court ran into problems. That June 18th date is 83 days from the initial hearing and well more than the 45 days allowed by law for the holding of the hearing. Subsequently, on April 9th, there was a letter from the father's attorney asking for the continuance. And then interestingly, in the record, without much explanation, there's an April 23rd order appointing a new attorney for my client. The inference I gather is that the attorney that had been assigned, Mr. Krause, probably could not handle the dates that were being sent out by the clerk's office, so a new attorney was appointed. And that order of appointment indicates April 23rd. On May 7th, my client's new attorney also wrote the court to ask for a postponement, and things went on and on basically from there.
Well, let's just stop there.
Right.
So under the Maruth case, why wouldn't these continuances that were asked by all sides been sufficient for this? You're saying that the crucial date happened before there was any request from your client? Is that your position?
My client, well, first of all, the question of waiver, I don't think really a request by my client necessarily would be exempt from the non-waiver rule of McCrutt because this is a Chapter 48 case, and it is a TPR case. But
dealing with your question, why isn't that a waiver, my client did not do anything until her attorney wrote on May 7th. In fact, there was no correspondence from my client's attorney prior to that date. And the case had already been recalendared for June 18th. It was clear that the case was not going to be heard at that point by May 12th, which would have been the deadline. It had already been rescheduled for June 18th.
Mr. Law, if I might interrupt, even if we were to decide that the Court of Appeals was wrong in using MICRA, doesn't 48.315 2MB take care of the problem?
No, I don't believe it does.
Why not?
I'll tell the Court why. 48.315 2MB is a very limited statute. It addresses really the situation 48.315 2M1, which basically says, when you look at the statutory schemes, right, Your Honor, 48.315 allows for continuances, generally, of these time deadlines. In 48.315 2M1, there are two instances where those continuances are not allowed. And those are two fact-finding hearings, a hearing to determine reasonable efforts to keep a child in the home when that child is first taken out of the home, has to be held within 60 days, no exceptions, no continuances, and also a fact-finding regarding reasonable efforts to comply with the permanency plan. Has to be, that hearing has to be within 12 months, and there's no exceptions for that. So those are the two situations that the statute addresses as far as not losing competency, and it makes sense. If there are no continuances allowed under the statute, the legislature has determined that they will not go so far as to say you lose competency if you can't meet those deadlines. But still, those are deadlines that have to be met. And I've been trying to check on the history of that statute. I thought it was pretty plain when I first read it, but it didn't apply to the general statute, just to those two sections mentioned. It seems to me, as best I can find, that this statute was part of the budget bill in 2001, and that it's basically a response to federal dictates regarding time periods in these types of cases, and it's a response to maintain funding. So they don't want to lose funding based on these two deadlines.
Do you think, however, it really expresses the policy of the legislature that missing time limits in Chapter 48 should not result in a loss of competency?
Yes, I do, mainly because that has been the understanding of the law, the case law. The legislature hasn't acted to change that case law, and when it did act, it only referred to competency in those two instances. Mm-hmm. The legislature very easily could have changed the law to say, in all circumstances involving a deadline under Chapter 48, that you don't lose competency and you in fact waive an objection if you don't object in a certain
way. In other words, you don't think that we should interpret that section broadly enough to cover your situation?
No, I don't think it covers our situation at all. We're dealing with the hearing, a fact-finding hearing that has to be heard within 45 days, not with the two isolated instances outlined in that statute.
How can you get rid of the 45 days? What can you do? Everybody's busy. Nobody can make it. The court can't make it. The parties can't make it. What do you do?
You have a hearing on the record.
Within the 45 days?
Yes.
Okay.
And you find good cause, if there is good cause. You find out why people can't make it. These cases are expected to be handled expeditiously. You ask people, why can't you be here? What's going on? What's your calendar like? What can we do? You try to work it out. And if you just can't do it, you continue it for cause, stating on the record what your reason is. And then someone could review it, I suppose, on appeal and decide if that constituted good cause.
There's a way of extending that 45 days. That's provided for in the statute.
Certainly.
So I once visited Children's Court in Milwaukee, and I spent the morning there. And what I saw were literally in maybe six cases, eight people, nine people, 10 people would come in on each case, they would make their appearances, and then they would say, and we want it continued until, and then give a 3-week, 4-week, whatever it is. And there was a court reporter there. It was all taken down, and the judge would say, continuance granted. And then another group would troop in. I thought, my goodness, that was the biggest waste of time I had seen in court ever. And why should you drag everybody in for a hearing in court just to get a continuance?
Because the first answer is the statute says you should.
Well, the statute says you can do it by telephone, too.
Yeah, right. And then, yes, I understand.
Right.
You can appear by phone, but they want it in court, on the record. And I think all that should, I think the legislature knows the problems, for instance, in Milwaukee, knows that this is hard to do, but they want these things heard. I mean, everything you see is they want these cases heard, and they want them heard quickly. Appellate timelines are compressed. Other statutes are changed to allow waiver, to allow the argument that there's no loss of competency. But TPR actions in Chapter 48 have not been changed. So I guess it's a hard situation many times for courts, but this is what the legislature has said they want.
When your client's counsel asked for a new date on May 7th, that was still within the 45-day period?
By 5 days, if I counted correctly.
Okay. So she asked for a continuance beyond the 45 days.
Well, he asked by letter.
Okay.
Yeah,
doesn't waive it. Your position is she cannot waive it unless it's open court or telephone call, right?
My position
on the record.
My position reading the case law is that you can't waive.
Cannot.
I'm sorry.
Cannot waive.
I'm sorry. Yes.
So she cannot, even within the 45 days, she cannot waive it except open court telephone call.
Cross. Or the statutory criteria for the continuance. I won't call it a waiver. In case law, this Court has noted that there are no procedures for waiver in Chapter 48. The way to have these cases delayed is through 48.315, and there are the procedures in there for how to do it.
Maybe I'm not understanding the juvenile code well enough, so I need some help. I'm looking at 48.315, Step 2. A continuance shall be granted by the court only upon a showing of good cause in open court or during a telephone conference under Section 807.13 on the record and only for so long as is necessary, taking into account the request or consent of the district attorney or the parties and the interests of the public in the prompt disposition of cases.
I agree.
Is it your position that does not apply?
No, not that sub 2 does not apply.
Say that again. What doesn't apply?
I'm not saying sub 2 does not apply. That says how it should be done.
It wasn't done that way.
It wasn't done that way.
If it had been done that way, you wouldn't be here.
Correct.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get at.
You are advocating the language of sub 2. That's what you're heralding, right?
I don't believe that's the... Yes, but
the reason I asked the question is because you said there can't be waiver. It seems that sub 2 gives you a way to waive, but you would have to waive under sub 2.
That's semantics with me. I understand,
okay,
Your Honor.
Okay.
I think I'm talking about a continuance. I'm not talking about a client coming into court and saying, for no good reason, I waive, this time limit without a reason for it. I think you have to establish reasons for it. Some waivers in some situations, you just might ask someone, do you waive this right? And they say yes. You make sure they knowingly are doing it, that they want to do it, and that's a waiver. I'm saying you really can't do that under these statutes. The court has to find that there's good cause for it. And what I was saying, what doesn't apply to our case is sub 2M. Those two situations where you do not lose competency if the hearings are not held on time. Those two hearings are not the hearings that we're dealing with in this case.
Well, you've got very broad language in Mikroth, which is a very recent case.
I understand.
It does not cover, it says, it doesn't cover statutory time limitations. It says that. But it seems to say that sure don't have very much confidence in cases like April O., that say statutory time limits can't be waived that you either follow it or you're out of court. Court loses power to work. How do you get around Mikvot? Or maybe you don't. Or maybe you don't think Mikvot applies.
Well, first of all, I don't think it should apply just because of the difference in the type of case it is and because it said it didn't apply. I think the Court of Appeals overstepped when it applied it here, saying it sub silentio overruled the prior cases, when in fact it expressly said it did not apply this, to this type of case. But then the question is, I guess, should it apply? And maybe that's what you're asking me. And I'd say no. I think Mikvot is based on, when you read it, it's based on two, I think, faulty assumptions. The first one is that this rule has been just perpetuated by rote, that statutory time limits are jurisdictional and therefore competency or jurisdiction can't be waived. I understand, and I haven't cited all these cases dealing with jurisdiction versus competency, but this court in BJN recognized the distinction between jurisdiction and competency cases and analyzed things in terms of competency, not jurisdiction, and also examined the legislative history of the Children's Code and found that these deadlines are important.
BJN was a delinquency case.
Correct. It did refer to, I understand, but it was talking about also predisposition timelines under the Children's Code, and the law has changed since then.
And in BJN, you had a one-year, I think it was a one-year disposition. They got a 30-day extension. They didn't comply with the 30-day extension, so the question was, what do you do when the order ceased 1 year and 30 days
right.
afterwards? And the question was, can it be waived because there wasn't appropriate objection at the earliest possible time? And the court said, and there they had 48.3152 that was operative. Yeah, and the court said that the disposition order, the expiration date, was not a time limit to which the tolling provisions of 315 applied.
Right.
But we don't have an expiration date here.
I understand.
So BJN has nice language for you, but it's really a very different fact situation.
Yes, but other courts since that time have interpreted it to this type of situation, and even Mikvot has cited, I think, Nadia S., I think it's Sally T., I always get the names confused, said that that case should be narrowed because it was overly broad when it said that you lose competency if for certain reasons, and limited it to this type of case and said you do lose competency and the rule of non-waiver doesn't apply in juvenile cases. This court in Mikvot assumed that that was the rule, and the Court of Appeals did not. I was going to say did also, but they did not. They took the Mikvot rule and applied it to this type of case when Mikvot itself said it did not, and that this type of case was a mandatory deadline and that there was a non-waiver rule for these cases. So I think that's been the established law, and I understand BJN is different on its facts, but that's how the law has developed, and that's what the legislature is, how it has seen the law develop over the years. And then we come to the point where the Juvenile Justice Code and the Children's Code basically are split. And that's the other reason, outside of the fact that this has not just been dealt with by rote, but the other reason why I think that this rule is still intact for TPRs is because of the change in the law that was cited in the Mikvot opinion, and I think it really supports our position and not the other position. And that change in the law is that Chapter 938 was established, which established the Juvenile Justice Code. And I think the Mikvot decision referred to 938.315 sub 3 and 48.315 sub 2M, which we talked about as statutes to like effect. And we take issue with that and say they're not to like effect. And if you put them side by side and read them, they're totally different. And what the legislature did in 938, in 1995, was expressly say that failure to comply with these timelines will not result in lost competency. And it also even used the word waiver and said that failure to object will constitute a waiver. The legislature obviously knows how to say that the timelines do not result in a loss of competency and knows how to address the issue of waiver and did so in Chapter 938, but has not done so in Chapter 48.
Counselor, I'd like to look again at that section, 48.315.2MA, and it, in my reading of it, incorporates sub 1 of the same section. So why isn't everything covered in then what follows as subsection B of 2MB?
Sub 1 of section 2M, not sub 1 of section 48.315.
No, but that's not what it says. It says subsection parent 1 parent. It doesn't say 1 period as it would say if it were talking about the section below it. It says, in reading in part, no period of delay specified in sub 1. It's 1, it's parent 1 parent, which in my view refers to parent 1 parent. So 48.315 parent 1 parent. So I think it picks up everything above it and it deals with two circumstances a little bit differently in sub 1 and sub 2 below it. But then when you go back and read subsection B, where it says you're not going to lose competence if you miss a time limit, it refers to parent A, and parent A incorporates sub 1. So I guess I don't read it as narrowly as you do, as applying only to two things. I think it applies to everything in sub 1. What's sub 1? Sub 1 is 48.315, parent 1, parent. The following time period shall be excluded in computing time requirements within this chapter, and then it talks about all of the different time requirements that are set forth therein.
I guess my first answer is I honestly don't read it that way,
okay.
Your Honor.
All right.
I do read it as referring to sub 1 in that specific statutory section.
But isn't how it refers to it. Usually they would do a 1 period if that's what they were talking about, because that's what it's set out as in the statute. Do you see where I'm having some problems?
Yes.
Okay. You may not read it the way I do, and frankly, I didn't read it that way at first either, but if you look in sub 1, when they refer to other sections of the statute that have a 1 that is a subsection of an alphabetical section, it gets very hard to speak about it rather than pointing to it, they do use the 1 period. But here they use parent 1 parent, which to me is a greater group of occasions than just the way we seem to be reading it here.
Let me just ask you this. You see sub, whatever it is, paragraph or subparagraph 1 period under 2M, and it has the court making initial finding under 48.215B, 48.355. Does this case come under any of those sections?
No.
No.
That's what I was saying before.
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
No.
Does it come under 48.385M, which is referred to in 2.
No, I don't believe so.
No. So, no continuance or extension of a time limit specified in this chapter may be granted, and no period of delay specified in 1 may be excluded in computing a time requirement under this chapter if the continuance, extension, or exclusion would result of any of the following. And your position, as I understood it, was this case does not come under 1 or 2.
That's correct.
Therefore, 2MA that gives the continuance doesn't apply to this case because it doesn't come under 1 or 2.
Right. This case, you can get a continuance if you do it right.
Yes, but not under 2M.
No, no.
The answer is that's right.
That's right.
You are just, Chief Justice, you were right as usual.
But that isn't what I was trying to focus
okay.
on.
That's your interpretation. Now I'm trying to understand the other interpretation.
I'm trying to focus you on sub B of 2M.
Okay.
And what it applies to, and it refers back to sub A of 2M, which in my view refers back to the whole statute, sub 1.
Oh.
You see what I mean? I think it steps backwards through itself. At least that's how I was.
What that is saying there mm-hmm. is that under these two circumstances we were talking about, you can't even get an extension under sub A.
Mm-hmm.
And because, and the way I read the statute, because you can't get an extension under sub A for those two situations that are mentioned, in those two situations, you don't lose competency if you miss the deadline. So it's referring back, I guess, to A.
Yeah, but A encompasses 1 and 2. That's your position. 2MA has to be read with 1 and 2.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
yes, you're correct.
Thank you. And I understood that. Okay. And paragraph A in B refers to 2MA. It does not refer to 1A.
I think it refers to all of 1, and that was my question to him.
But that's his problem.
And I'm just kind of wanting him to help me with it, because I don't think anybody's talked about it that way.
Herb, do you understand what Justice Rogenczyk is saying to you?
You're missing it then, because...
I think what she is saying, that under sub B, the reference to paragraph A, and please correct me, Justice Rogenczyk.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel and I read paragraph A in sub B to refer to 2MA, which includes 1 and 2. I think you are reading paragraph A in sub B to refer back to subsection 1.
Exactly.
A. That's right.
Exactly.
And that would... If that were true, then that would be specified in subsection 1, paren A, paren, or paragraph A of subsection 1. I mean,
yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
Okay. One way to check that is through the Legislative Reference Bureau drafting manual to see how they make cross-references.
I did just find, I see my lights on.
Yeah.
I found something from the drafting bureau regarding the statute.
Okay. What'd you find?
It's a note on page 18 of what's called the Rationale for Proposed Legislative Changes Related to the Federal Adoption on Safe Families Act. And it talks about computing time periods on page 18 of what I found regarding 48.315. And it's drafting instructions. The instruction is to establish in statute that the reasonable efforts to prevent removal finding, which is one of those, must be made within 60 days of the child's removal from the home, and the reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency plan finding, which was the other one, must be made within 12 months from the date of the removal of the child from the home, and every 12 months thereafter, with no exception to timelines. Federal funding will be unavailable if the strict timelines are not adhered to. Then handwritten there is no continuances or exceptions.
That's under 1 and 2. So paragraphs 1 and 2. The first one is the 60 days. The second day is the 12 months.
The 12 months, yes.
Okay, but that just says you can't get extensions if those are your circumstances. But those are not our circumstances, and
right.
There was an extension. The question is whether you can get an extension for this, right?
Right, and you can get an extension for this, but if you do it the right way, has been our position.
But the question is, do you lose competence if you don't do it the right way?
Right.
Right.
And I think you do, because in other situations the legislatures provide in these two, that you don't lose competence, so you can infer that in the situations like ours you do, because that is the way the law is developed, and that they also have changed the law in Chapter 938, but did not change the law in Chapter 48. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Wagner, Assistant District Attorney of Sheboygan County.
Please report. My name is Mary Wagner. I'm an Assistant District Attorney for Sheboygan County, and I represent the Sheboygan County Department of Health and Human Services in this action. And before I launch into my whole public policy speech, I believe there is a small mystery that came up at the first part of the argument that I could possibly add a little information to. It was regarding the withdrawal of Rachel's first attorney and why the delay was requested. I don't have the exact number in the record, but there was a letter on April 22nd of 2003 from the managing attorney of the State Public Defender's Office, Russ Van Skyke, explaining that attorney Wayne Fully Love Krause had asked to be relieved from the case because he was not certified to do TPR cases. Attorney Sykes, Van Skyke, explained that the public defender had office had had a great difficulty finding another lawyer who was certified, but that Attorney Gerleman, who then became Rachel's second attorney, was willing to take the appointment but needed dates moved back as well because he had a prior teaching commitment. So at that point, the dates were asked to be moved back by assistant public defender Russ Van Skyke.
Was that done on the record or was that done by letter?
I believe that was done by letter. I just went through the record recently, and I don't think that one was put on the record orally. It was just a letter that came into the court. So,
in Sheboygan County, are many of the continuances and extensions done by mail?
I don't know. In all honesty, I don't do TPR cases. I have no idea. We are here asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision in this case and to extend the waiver rule which you established in the Mickrick case last year to the issue of time limits in TPR cases. This decision would modify or at least distinguish the court's ruling in BJN to reflect the changes that have been made to the state children's code and to federal and state adoption law since then. It would also recommend the fundamental differences between what due process demands for juvenile and CHIPS matters and separately for TPR cases. At its most basic, what this case is about is whether a mother whose parental rights were terminated can challenge whether the trial court complied with the time limits in the case for the first time on appeal. The Court of Appeals held that she could not, that she had raised this issue too late. The little boy at the center of this case, Joshua, is now 3 years old. He was a year and a half when the department filed the petition to terminate. He had lived in foster care since the age of 2 months. This case is a picture-perfect example, a clear and concise snapshot of why the waiver rule should be extended to competency challenges based on time limits in TPR cases. We ask the court to extend this rule to cases like these because to do otherwise means that the interest of children like Joshua will, in fact, come last among all the parties involved.
The thing that bothers me, and I would like to think that the way we should interpret Chapter 48 when there's a question, is to protect the children. Now, I recognize and accept we should protect the rights of the parents, but and even if we protect all of them here, we have a petition filed in March, early March, and there's no hearing here until October. That's a huge amount of time for a child, or children in this case, right?
It is the one child at issue.
Okay, one child. And it seems to me that the heat should be put on everybody to move on these children. And March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, 7 months before there's a hearing, when there's a 45-day statute.
Well, it's a 45-day statute with some exceptions, and I believe one of the exceptions is that pending motions essentially toll the time limits. And in this case, the father had filed a motion for severance in April before the 45-day time limit had run out. It is our position that that stopped the clock running on the 45 days until that hearing could be heard, and then the decisions that were made in terms of continuances after that were made properly.
No, but it still doesn't cover 7 months.
It's a long time, and this was a very complicated case. I think ultimately between the father's and the mother's cases, it took a total of 5 days. The mother went through three attorneys. Mr. Grau on appeal is her fourth. Due process was not
violated. She was in prison?
Pardon?
She was in prison?
The father is in prison.
And she?
He was in and out of jail.
Okay.
And
there's a fight among the family members as to whether the child should be placed with a family member?
Yes, the father's grounds for appeal, one of his grounds for appeal was that he wanted more emphasis placed on the possible placement with his parents while he was off in prison.
While the child's in a foster home?
In the meantime, the child has been in foster care since 2 months. And so I believe in this case, and a due process concern has been raised, of course, in Mr. Grau's argument in Mr. Grau's brief towards the end of it, that somehow due process has been compromised in the span of time that has occurred here. But in fact, due process has not been violated. It has been absolutely exhausted in this case. The trial court bent over backward to ensure that Rachel have her day in court properly represented with an attorney.
Ms. Wagner, regarding the waiver rule and your argument regarding MCRA, isn't there something internally inconsistent about your argument that the petitioner objected too late to the fact that you missed the deadlines? In other words, it sounds like everybody has... you're objecting because they objected too late, but they're objecting because you didn't act in time. It's the converse of the same coin. It's the other side of the coin here. I understand the argument, but it just seems a bit inconsistent that you're saying you didn't object to the fact that we didn't move fast enough in time.
I'm sorry, you lost me.
Well, you're arguing waiver. You're saying that they should have raised this in the trial court, that they didn't object in time. They didn't object when they should have. But their objection is that you didn't do what you were supposed to when you should have.
I believe we did what we were supposed to do. It was, if anybody didn't do something, it was the trial court. And I believe, as part two of my brief I outlined, I believe that the trial court did it right in the first place. However, it's my understanding I'm here for a command performance on the subject of waiver and how MCRA should or should not apply to this case. And so I think the trial court did it right. But.
Counsel, one of the points that rings to me is that 938.315.3 has a provision that specifically addresses waiver and failure to object to a continuance time limit that the subject of the period of delay, etc. Anyway, failure to object is a waiver. But 948.315 doesn't have the corresponding sub 3.
This is true. And if I could take you on a brief history of the Children's Code since before BJN and what has led into this. Essentially, when the Children's Code was split off in 1995, or the Juvenile Code was split off from, okay, let me back up a decade.
Children's Code was adopted in the 70s, late
70s. Yes, in the 1970s. At that point, it was a one-size-fits-all statute. It governed everything. It had what amounted to CHIPS petitions, it had juvenile delinquency actions, it had adoptions, and it had termination of parental rights cases. Mm-hmm. Everything under one umbrella. The cases that interpreted timelines since then, and of course, that addressed the legislative history, such as in the interest of SDR from 1982, which fed into the BJN case, in the RH and LH cases of 1989, in BJN in 1991, all of the analysis of the legislative history went back to the time in 1977 when things had to be fixed because the children at issue, I think basically mostly delinquency matters, their due process rights were being violated because there was an open-ended nature to the court supervision. And so the timelines were put in place analogous to timelines in criminal proceedings where the state has a certain finite amount of time to put up or shut up in terms of a case to release, you know, to bring the case against an individual or to go home and release the person from involuntary confinement or the possibility of involuntary confinement. All of those cases spoke to that issue. In fact, at the risk of sounding impertinent or like the little boy in the fairy tale on the side of the road looking at the parade and saying the emperor has no clothes, I'm going to ask the court to eventually, somewhere in the next half hour, look at the possibility that the case of BJN does not have much of relevance to say to this particular TPR issue at all. But anyway, the cases that distinguished or that interpreted those deadlines all involved CHIPS dispositions, such as the BJN case and the RH and LH case. The SDR case was delinquency matters. Again, all of these involve the court's ability to exercise its continuing control over a child. Far removed from a TPR case where these are private interests, where the court comes in with a draconian solution and says, this private party, the parent, can no longer be a parent to this private individual, the child. So, fast forward ahead to 1995 when the Juvenile Code was split off from the Children's Code and all the delinquency matters set off into a separate chapter. And at that time, in 938.315 sub 3, the legislature, in fact, wrote into law the waiver rule, which is the very thing that we are arguing about today in relation to this case. They took that off the table and wrote the waiver rule into law for juvenile delinquency cases, leaving the argument about the strictness of time limits to apply only to CHIPS cases and to the TPR cases. So the interests, again, involved are so far different in what those early analyses and the BJN analyses and the RH and the LH and the SDR analyses of timelines, so far different. What is at risk? The liberty interests that are at risk in a TPR case are so far removed that I believe that the court should take, I guess, a different path of analysis towards that and apply the waiver rule in this case.
Ms. Wagner, can I go back to something you said earlier? Because it struck me that we don't have to apply the waiver rule if you're correct in what you said. And if I misunderstood what you said, you stop me, okay? My understanding was that you said that there was a motion for severance.
Yes.
That was brought by the father, that would have told the time periods under 48.315.1A, and that after that continuance, after that motion was decided, then everything else was done correctly and in accordance with the statutes. And I guess my question is, were you referring at that point to 48.315.2, the one that talks about good cause and talks about on the record or by phone conference? Is that what you had reference to?
Yes, that they were continuing. At that point, from the time that the severance motion was denied, that things were handled properly since then on the record.
If that's true, why do we even have to talk about the MCRUD rule or waiver? If that's indeed the case, then those two statutes take care of the problem.
Because I've been invited here to argue it, I don't
know.
You can tell us that there's a way of taking care of this case, if that's true, without getting into the issue of MCRUD and waiver and the approach the Court of Appeals took.
The Court of Appeals, I believe, did go out on a limb when it took what it, in good faith, took what it felt was the feeling of the Supreme Court on the waiver rule in general and applied it to the time limits in this case. Yes, I believe this case could be decided very narrowly on those technical grounds. I believe that it would serve public policy, however, for this Court to extend that waiver rule to time limits in TPR cases.
I'd like to decide it on a narrow ground and maybe extend MCRUD, but I don't see the narrow ground because it seems to me, and this is where I may not understand Justice Crooks and may not understand your response, even if you can get a tolling under 1A on the motion, you're still out of 45 days, no matter how you do it. Unless you can come under sub 2. And Justice Crooks asked you whether you can come under sub 2.
That's
right.
Right?
Right. And my understanding was she said yes, you could.
That's right. And I think your answer has to be no. And this is why. Sub 2, I want to make sure we're all talking about the same subsection. A continuance shall be granted by the court only upon a showing of good cause in open court. Now, there was, as I understand it, now I have not read the separate box of the record, but my understanding is that there was no court proceeding in open court far within the 45 days or thereafter until we got into October. Is that right?
There were proceedings in open court on the record. Prior to that, there was the motion for severance that was heard in May. And when I look at that statute in the initial language of 48.315 and even the title where it talks about delays, continuances, and extensions, I guess, I would think that a delay, it's just me, I would think that a delay caused by a pending motion would somehow be categorized differently from a continuance. Is it necessary for every pending motion to have an open court discussion of the need to, I don't know.
But other than the severance motion, is there a continuance, was a continuance granted by the court
upon a showing of good cause in open court or during a telephone conference under 807.13 on the record, and only for so long as is necessary, taking into account requests of the DA, the parties, etc. Now, Justice Crooks's question to you is, was sub 2 satisfied? And my response is, if sub 2 is satisfied, it's satisfied. And you don't have to go any further because that allows a delay, continuance, and extension over the 45 days. It is opposing counsel's claim that 2 was not satisfied. So I guess the question to you is, if this sub 2 was satisfied, how and on what day or dates? Isn't that, in essence, what we have to do?
Didn't you say that was satisfied after the motion for severance was denied? It was granted, I guess. So after that motion was decided, then sub 2 clicked in and things were done on the record. Is that what you were telling
yes,
us?
Yes, basically.
And then if you look under 48.3151, if I can just finish, 48.3151 says you don't count in the computing of the time any delay resulting from pre-hearing motions, right? So is that what you're relying on? So you don't even count those days, so it doesn't matter about the 45 days until the motion is decided, and then after that point, you said any delay was done, a continuance was done on the record. Am I right on what?
Yeah, that is. And in fact, actually, the motion for severance was initially denied by the trial court. That was Judge Murphy.
Okay.
That was back in May. And then in August, I believe at the beginning, I looked at a transcript of some motion hearing at that point. And it was at the beginning of the father's trial that then the trials were agreed to be severed. And there was no real discussion of it other than that it was agreed to by all of the parties. I believe the fact that this was 5 days of fact-finding had something to do with whether it could fit in the court calendar.
If you could answer the Chief's question now as to what dates sub 2 did. I want to know what date. First of all, you have a severance is denied in May.
Yes.
So even if the time was told, now we're dealing with 45 days from May. Is that right?
No, I think that it would have, the way I read it, would have expanded the statutory deadline to June 13. Because part of that 45 days had run before the severance motion.
Okay, now we're at June 13th. We still don't have a hearing until October.
Yes.
So how do you extend it from, I mean, accepting your facts and your view, how do you get it extended from June 13th to October? That's still more than 45 days.
Well, on May 19th, this is true. On May 19th, the court took up the matter of scheduling the fact-finding hearing and noted on the record in open court that nobody basically was available. Through June, the attorneys for both parents and the child were going to be on vacation in June. The fact-finding hearing itself was going to be lengthy and complicated, and in fact, the case against the mother likely more complicated than the one against the father, that the fact-finding could potentially take up to 4 days. And at that point, it was scheduled by the trial court for August 7th and August 8th. And I believe that is what occurred in open court.
So you think that's a continuance?
Yes, even if the judge did not say the magic words, continuance granted for good cause, it is clear from the record that he did, that this was not done arbitrarily, that this is not done without regard for the parents' due process rights or the child's due process rights, but this was a matter of necessity.
And then, so give me the time. So that was May 19th in open court. And then the father's trial date was when?
August 7th and 8th. And at August 7th and 8th, the motion for severance, I believe that's when the motion for severance was finally granted by Reserve Judge Williamson or what?
After it was already denied, it's now granted.
Yes, and they did not have any discussion in the record as to why, other than that it was done with the consent of the parties. In speaking with the deputy district attorney who actually handled the case, I was given the understanding that it was just such a complicated thing that it would fit better to have them separately. So I don't know why Judge Murphy initially denied it in the first place, or why Judge Williams granted it in the second place. All I know is that the trial court did voice concern throughout, and commendable concern, for the ability of Rachel to be represented by counsel during this critical proceeding. And, in fact, this did take place with a third attorney representing her after Thomas Gerleman withdrew. In asking the court to
Okay, how do we get to an open record? We got it now into July. A continuance was granted until July. How do we then get a continuance granted by the court upon a showing of good cause in open court, but during a telephone conference extending it beyond July? Seems to me that under the cases, you've got to have, within the time period set for the continuance, another continuance, so that you're all, there are no gaps. The cases talk about gaps, right? Me, I know you don't like BJN and you don't want it applied here, but that's the conversation in BJN about gaps.
And in part, BJN was a very strict construction because it was a specific statute that governed over the general and...
I understand that. But do you have a gap here? I mean, do you have another open court proceeding continuing?
Beyond those, I don't think so.
So there was a continuance till July?
Of July.
Then
you said August.
Then there's a hearing on August 7th, and it's severanced. And then how do you get to October?
I think we got to October from the August 6th and 7th hearing, the fact-finding hearing for the father, which was, by reading the transcript, I believe, in open court. There wasn't a discussion as to why that was set off until October.
So it's not good cause wasn't necessarily stated on the record.
It wasn't stated on the record. It wasn't ruled out. In looking at the proceedings of this entire case, I don't think you could possibly rule out good cause and the attorney's schedules. In asking the court to extend this waiver rule,
before you get to that, just one final question. Can a court for good cause extend the time after the time has already run?
That was the issue in April O.
Mm-hmm.
And there seemed to be little logic for it. I would ask you to look at the underpinnings of the Court of Appeals decision in April O, however, when they decided that. And frankly, the court's conduct in the April O case was, I think, in some ways inexcusable up in Brown County, because they had no discussion on the record as to why anything needed to be continued, why anything was being delayed. It just happened, and finally, a year afterwards, when it's finally been remanded by the Court of Appeals, the court says, oh, well, congestion in the court calendar certainly constituted good cause enough. And at that point, there certainly is a logical break. But the April O case, which is, of course, a substantial part of the legal discussion here and the train of cases that go on, again, as in BJN, relies in a TPR case where the fundamental liberty interests are vastly different, and the conclusion, which takes the court out of the picture, so different from the juvenile and Chips case, rests its reasoning on the cases of BJN, which was a Chips disposition, and the cases of RH and LH from 1989, which were Chips and juvenile cases. Again, applying standards that were crafted with these particular due process liberty interests involving the children in those cases to something that is radically different. And I can't say that the Court of Appeals applied that in error, because I don't think there is any other relevant case law on this point, but I've only looked as far as 1982. Once I got to SDR, I sort of ran out of steam. But
Ms. Wagner, you talk about the different interests, the due process interests in the criminal children's proceeding, but the United States Supreme Court and this Court has characterized the interests of a parent in raising one's child as being essential and fundamental. So that there seem to be at least decisions that would put the right to parent one's child, absent the TPR grounds, in the same type of character, I mean, the same degree of importance. So I'm not sure that your divergence really flows between the delinquency and the TPR setting. If the right of appearance is fundamental, absent the grounds that are stated in the TPR statutes, you understand why you're going with that?
Sort of, and I believe you're citing back to Stanley v. Illinois from 1972, where the U.S. Supreme Court says that a case involving a parent's relationship with their child comes to the court with the momentum for respect that is lacking in cases that revolve simply around shifting economic arrangements. Yes, it is in Stanley v. Illinois and Lassiter in Santosky v. Kramer and even in the cases that this Court has decided in the last 12 months, that... Yes. There is an incredible amount of respect accorded to the parent's rights. The child, however, has a right as well. In this case, the delays, due process was absolutely recognized and accorded every respect by the trial court in relation to this particular mother and child. The reason I say that, and in fact the delays that were granted by the trial court in her benefit, so that her attorneys could be brought up to speed, so that she could be properly represented by a certified attorney in this case, worked to her advantage and against that of the department, if anybody. I mean, the department has the lowest interest here. The parent has this fundamental liberty interest in the raising of their child. The child has an extremely high interest in being parented properly. We're just the vehicle for getting the case moving. But,
and if I could, to follow up on that point, as a practical matter, depending upon whether this court says you can have extensions and continuances or it takes the position that you can't have extensions and continuances, that the time limits are mandatory, if you would, as a practical matter, kind of give us an idea of what would happen if we follow each of those paths in the court system. What's going to happen in the TPR setting?
In a TPR setting, if the time limits, and I guess the question is not whether the time limits should be mandatory or directory, because, of course, that was already decided in the LH and RH cases. The question is, or could be considered, if the time limits are indeed mandatory, can an objection based on, a competency objection based on the violation of the time limits be waived? If...
I'm talking about what's actually going to happen in the court system. Are we going to have long delays, or are people going to have to run the courts 24 hours a day? Are we going to need to have additional courts? That's what I'm trying to get at. What's going to happen, depending upon which direction we follow in this argument? What's actually going to happen out there in the trial court setting?
I have no idea. But I do believe that if you take Mr. Grau's argument as the one that carries the day here, that the time limits where the discussion was set in BJN and all those other cases involving CHIPS and juvenile cases involving the court's power to exercise control over an individual rather than these. If you follow his, the children at issue will be spending more time in foster care because the TPR cases, if they can be dismissed at this late date upon motion after a trial where due process has been fully heard, the right to confrontation, the right to produce witnesses, the right to confront your accusers. And, in fact, it would not have taken much to defeat this case because this is one that's based on a continuing need for protection and services. The mother did not even have to demonstrate that she had met the CHIPS conditions, only that she'd be able to do this in the following year. If the case can then, at this late date, be dismissed upon motion because of a violation of a time limit, the child keeps sitting in foster care that much longer while a new petition is drafted. This, I believe, runs contrary to both the federal adoption of the Safe Families Act and the state adoption of the Safe Families Act, which essentially brought the state into compliance with federal foster care funding statutes, which were set in 1997. So if you follow Mr. Grau's interpretation, the parent is going to win a motion like this much easier, and the child is going to sit in foster care that much longer. And there has been an evolution in foster care and adoption law over the last decade that understand, oh, actually the last two decades, it's about, oh well, last two decades, that more time spent in foster care runs contrary to the good of the child.
You know, I certainly, how can I dispute that? But it seems to me that if you have mandatory timelines, and we do, and that if they just can't be put off willy-nilly because people's schedules aren't very convenient, and then this and then that. I mean, there's always something else that floats to the top. There's always something else that takes precedent. And that may be the best way to make sure that kids spend less time in foster home is to make sure that these time limits and the procedure for adhering to these time limits are met.
That's a multi-pronged question.
Well, it's an observation, and I guess I'd like you to respond to. I mean, you suggest that, you know, in this specific case, that it's contrary to the purpose of the federal legislation of getting kids shorter times in foster home. And it seems to me that very purpose, which is a purpose I and probably everyone would embrace in general, maybe not in specific cases, but in general, is adhered to. I mean, my life experience tells me it's you get things moving along when you have deadlines and you keep to them. I don't care whether I'm writing an opinion or I'm, you know, trying to get the house clean. I mean, you know, that's my life experience.
Well, in a case like this, haste can do more harm than good. One thing is the court noted in Mikret last year in establishing the waiver rule. The trial court always has the ability to ignore a waiver rule in the interest of justice. And so if there's a parent in a TPR case who has actually been prejudiced by the march of time that does not comply with those statutory deadlines, the trial court can always take that up and address it, even if she has not brought it up herself. In this case, every day that passed was actually an advantage for Rachel. I say that she was advantaged by this because every day that passed gave her one more day to comply with that CHIPS order or to at least demonstrate that she could do so within the following year. Every day that passed was one more day that she could pull her life together and provide a proper home for her child to be able to walk into court and say, this petition is no longer relevant. And even if the jury verdict was a foregone conclusion, every day that passed gave her one more day to assemble a set of circumstances that would allow her to argue at disposition that Joshua's best interest was best served by staying with her rather than having him completely severed from her and extended family and everything. And so, yes, the timelines that were put in place in the Children's Code back in 1977 are important. And in general, they do serve an important purpose to get the child out of foster care and keep these things moving, and particularly the ASFA in 1997 and the state's compliance with that, which requires a district attorney or whoever the prosecutor is in that particular county to file termination proceedings for a child who's been in foster care for 15 out of the preceding 22 months. But on a strict interpretation to say if the timeline isn't met, then the case goes out the window, it ultimately results in a longer injustice to the child. Now, in a case where, as I said, if the parent is actually prejudiced by the fact that the timeline has been blown for some reason, say in April, without any explanation by anybody, the trial court has the ability to say, you know, state, sorry, you missed it, file another one. And at that point, the time that has elapsed is not such a serious, it's not that big of a time span. In a case like this, an inordinate amount of time has gone by between the properly conducted trial with counsel by both sides, full exploration of the issues, then through the appeal, then to the Supreme Court. You're adding on an extra year at least for that child to sit. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Mr. Graham? Mr. Graham, did they ever satisfy sub 2?
No. I would like to go back to that one point Justice Crooks raised about this motion and what effect that motion has on this case. It's our position that motion had nothing to do with what happened here.
Which motion are you talking about?
The motion to sever.
Okay.
It was filed or heard on I think May 19th that was heard. What happened is this case was rescheduled by just a notice from the clerk on April 4th. That's when the notice of hearing went out, rescheduling it for June 18th. That motion wasn't filed till after that scheduling notice went out. There's no way that motion caused
the late date here. In fact, when the father...
It didn't cause the late date, but in the statute it says you don't count the time while the motion is pending. That's what's bothering me.
The time that is lost as a result of the motion being filed. There was no time lost here as a result of that motion being filed. That motion was calendared to accommodate the hearing date that was already set. In fact, when the prospect of that motion was first raised at the initial appearance, the judge said, file it, we've got 45 days. It wasn't filed, as directed by the judge, until April 9th or so. He didn't file it right away and just got a motion date that coincided and was heard before the trial date that had already been scheduled. So that trial date, the calendaring of that trial date, was not the result of that motion. It's the other way around. The motion date was the result of the trial date, which had already been calendared prior to the motion being filed. So I don't think the pre-hearing motion language really takes care of this problem at all, because it just is not a cause and effect relationship there. As I said, the fact-finding hearing had already been scheduled.
I want to ask you the same question I asked of Ms. Wagner, and perhaps I didn't phrase it artfully, and please excuse me if I don't. This is the end of the term, and I think the case is starting to run together. But having been out of children's court recently and walking through and visiting each of the courtrooms, I had somewhat a similar experience that the Chief referred to earlier, and I guess my concern is, what will the practical effect of our ruling be? Should we either follow your position or should we follow Ms. Wagner's position? What's going to happen to the litigants and what's going to happen to the court system, depending upon which way we go?
I think things will get slower. I mean, that's our position.
Slower if we follow which, yours or hers?
Oh, hers. Okay. Yeah, not mine. What will happen here, and in this case is a good example. You want to avoid what I think is kind of a mess. You don't have hearings on the record. You have calendar clerks sending out dates on TPR cases when we have mandatory deadlines. I think that's only going to be exacerbated if there's really no mechanism for enforcement. This is a way that this can be enforced. There's a danger in looking at this. One of the cases talks about looking at these on an ad hoc basis, you know, on a case-by-case basis. If you look at this child, maybe you think it's a problem, maybe you don't. But if you look at the system as a whole, you have to make sure these deadlines are filed. And the way to do that is to enforce the non-waiver rule. It's fallen upon parents on appeal to be the ones to object. I have reviewed fairly many of these cases. I have yet to see the state appeal a time deadline. I've yet to see a court obviously appeal the missing of a time deadline. This is how these things are enforced. I don't think it's an unduly burdensome system that's set up. Calendaring is uniquely within the...
Right, just in the Milwaukee Children's Court.
I've been in Milwaukee Children's Court.
They seem to have long lines. They seem to be working late hours. And if you listen to the judges, they could use three or four more judges out there.
I understand. And that is a legislative decision, I think, to go to the legislature and say this is a problem, if it truly is a problem for Milwaukee. I don't practice much in Milwaukee County. I'm in Waukesha. And I think that's something that should be addressed if there's just something that's unworkable. But in Sheboygan, in this case, it sure could have been handled different. We don't need clerks just sending out notices. Rescheduling things is apparently how it was done. I'm sure someone ran it by a judge. I would think that would have to have happened. But still, it's done by mail. No one's appearing on the record. No one's really given an opportunity to object at the time. I suppose you could come in later and object. We've got attorneys just kind of coming and going. I think the comment was made, Rachel went through two or three attorneys. She didn't go through any attorneys. I mean, she had these attorneys assigned to her. I don't see that she was requesting that they leave or whatever. It's just the calendaring situation here was a mess because apparently no one was ever consulted regarding their calendars when these things were scheduled.
Counselor, does the guardian ad litem take any position in this matter?
It opposes me. Doesn't agree with me. That's all I know.
Guardian ad litem prefers that the TPR remain in place.
Sure. That's my understanding. As I said, the courts are the ones who can control their calendars. And there's some factors when you look at waiver. You know, one of the things pointed out in McCourt is the idea of sandbagging. This is not a secret defense that someone has, you know, laying in the weeds. These are mandatory time limits that people should know about. You want people to know about those. And I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Mr. Wagner, Ms. Wagner, for your discussion of Chapter 48 and the time limits and the group. That ends our hearing on 04-0901 Sheboygan County DSS versus Matthew S. And that is our last oral argument for this season until September, the court hopes. And thank you for appearing. And we are adjourned. The court will meet at 3 promptly.